Welcome to MGO Podcast 13.1. There might be some wooing in the background. That's not my fault. All right, we are doing a remote version of our podcast because I am in Nashville. The wooing will start imminently, I believe. It is about 8 in the morning Central Time. But and the wooing never stops at this place.
So that was a throw.
A throw? What?
That was a throw. The throw, the J.J. McCarthy throw, the future of Michigan football in one big throw. I'm just moving right on to that.
Is that what we're going to woo about that? We're going to sit in a bus that doesn't have a top and listen to Party in the USA and go woo about that? Well, maybe we should. Anyway, I'm Brian Cook. This is the MGO Bug Podcast.
I'm Seth Fisher.
And I'm Alex Drain.
And we have a list of sponsors who would love for you to purchase their services and or products.
Indeed, we are sponsored by Underground Printing. UGP makes custom apparel such as t-shirts and sweatshirts and was founded by two Michigan alums over 20 years ago. They have three retail locations in Ann Arbor, offer thousands of University of Michigan athletic products for sale, ranging from clothing to accessories and memorabilia and Hail to the Victors. Check them out at ugpmichiganapparel.com. We also want to thank our associate sponsors, Peak Wealth Management, Homeshore Lending, Signal Wire, Ann Arbor Elder Law, Michigan Law Grad, Human Element, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, the Raw Power app by iOS, by Gentleman Coders, and Prentice 4M. We were supposed to be right now, but we are not. But it's an excellent space.
Indeed. So we probably shouldn't actually lead with a backup quarterback throwing a pass in a game that is 40-7.
True.
I mean,
but
but apparently we already have.
I mean, if you close your eyes and remember this game, it's the Denard moment, right? It's the shoelace moment, and that's what happens when you play Western Michigan. All of the crap, all of the, you know, from losing the last game of the last season, and then going through this horrible offseason, and then the Broncos come to town, and like everything is okay again. Not necessarily everything, but like it, that's what Western Michigan games are for, right? They're for hope.
Yeah, I would agree with Seth. I mean, that's kind of what will hang in the mind, but there was a lot of other stuff to talk about, so we can get back to the McCarthy thing later.
All right, let's get back to the McCarthy thing later. So unfortunately, I think the number one takeaway from this game is that Ronnie Bell was going to be a really, really good player. And now he's going to be watching from the sideline in sort of an Eric Mays capacity, which is really, I mean, poor damn Ronnie Bell. Has there been a more poor damn Michigan player in the past decade or so? First, he has all those balls fly off his fingertips. And then he makes the catch of the year and has it taken away by a ridiculous...
By John O'Neill!
Well, like, to be fair, one of his side judges, not John O'Neill.
Doesn't matter. John O'Neill's crew is John O'Neill, because like they all come together to form the John O'Neill experience, and then he
gets a 76-yard touchdown, and then rips off a big punt return that he is injured on and presumably lost for the season. We had the whole can't put any pressure on the knee, gets carted off. Those aren't situations that you come back from.
Yeah. I mean, you've watched enough football. You've watched that guy do that. I mean, if he comes back this year, it would be incredible. But they were talking in practice like he was elite this year, and Sam Webb was just like beside himself when that happened, because like they. You're right. We saw it. We saw it, like the fade that he got the touchdown on was just. Absolutely, you cannot play that any better. We'd never seen a catch like that one-handed catch by Ronnie Bell. I mean, we've never seen something like that by most receivers. But like that was not even considered part of Ronnie Bell's repertoire. And the talk was that he'd been making those kinds of plays in practice as well. So,
this is the you want to get out of these games healthy, and Michigan lost, I think, one of their real key pieces, and that's unfortunate. And there was a big debate on Twitter about whether putting Ronnie Bell on punt return was a risk worth taking. And I'm kind of been in the no category. The next guy up is Caden Kolasar. Maybe that changes your equation a little bit. Cause this is a spot where losing Giles Jackson was actually a big deal, right?
Yeah.
If he's still on the roster, he's returning those, and you aren't putting you're spreading out the risk. Now there's not ton of risk returning punts because you're going to fair catch a bunch of them. And I don't think you're likely to get lit up in a way that is more likely to make you injured on a punt return, but it is anytime you get a touch, there is some risk. And so if you can spread it out, that's what you should do. But if a walk-on safety is your next option, maybe you can't spread it out.
I mean, the coaches have been pretty consistent with trying to get a guy who can flag those down. And you notice when Caden Kolasar came in, he let a couple of them bounce near the end zone, which could have landed at like the 1 yard line. We got lucky bounces on both of those. But
he was trying, like, you know, the
he did that 200 times.
Had an amazing knack for just having his punts just stop.
Yeah.
Most of his punts went backwards. There were a couple incidents where it was pretty scary that there was going to be one of those fire drill muffs where someone gets hit in the back. But I thought his decisions to not field those were fine. Usually you don't put your feet inside the 10. Those were landing inside the 10.
Yeah. There were two, I think, around the 10-yard line because Western was doing a lot of punting near the end of the game. But anyway, I thought that he couldn't get to a couple of them that Ronnie Bell could have gotten to. And I just want to make that the point about as far as using Ronnie Bell, that's what the coaches look for first, right? They always use Peppers back there or DPJ, somebody who they know can get to the punt first, because that's the most important thing in the modern punt game, in college at least. In the NFL, it's a little different because punts are more returnable. But in college, most of the time, you're just getting to the ball and fair catching it and saving any yards from the ball bouncing behind you. And you can't, like, trust that the ball's always going to bounce backwards, right? Like, that's a little weird.
That's not really addressing the
but when you
question here.
What I'm saying, as far as why do you use Ronnie Bell in that position? If Ronnie Bell is by far the best guy you have at doing that, and, I mean, the consideration of, like, will your best guy get injured, most of the time you're fair catching it. If you return it, most of the time you're actually running out of bounds, or you should not have returned it. So you really do want that, you know, you don't want a guy who's going to pick up returns because he tries to run with it and then gets knocked down. Like, and then...
Wait, this game is football. You try to run with it and then you get knocked down.
That's
what happens
no,
with every play.
Immediately knocked down. You don't want the guy who's not going to fair catch and then like get hit and get lit up.
If you can get 5 yards on a return, people are like, yeah, we get 5 yards on a return. I think that's crazy, Seth.
No, it's not. Knowing when to fair catch is part of that play. It's not crazy at all. Knowing when to fair catch is a big deal. Because if you're going to catch the ball and get lit up within 1 second, then...
Yeah, but people don't do that.
Yes, they do. They do it all the time. So many, because right. They're college kids. The ball comes to them, and they're like, I want to run.
Move on.
All right.
Move on. Stop.
I want to just throw a couple things in here. You know, I thought that the Bell injury, that play sequence showcased how just horrible it was, right? Because it comes right after he had a great return. It's a live line drive punt. It's an electric play by him, and then he gets hurt, and it's just kind of like, man. But secondly, do you guys remember the Madden curse? The idea that whoever player was on the Madden cover had something bad happen?
Are you saying there's a Hail of the Victors curse now?
I think there's a Hail of the Victors curse. Shea in 2019 regresses. Nico last year opts out, and now Ronnie Bell injured in the first game.
I don't know if we, like... So with Madden, we're talking about picking out one player from a successful NFL team. It could be anybody. And successful NFL teams have not been cursed by a monkey's paw. So I think it's unfair to blame Hail to the Victors for something that seems to be like a Michigan football thing.
Well, then maybe we should put an Ohio State guy on the cover and let's see what happens.
I mean, Taylor Lewan was on the cover. Hurst. Well, I'm defending my covers. Rashawn Gary, he was all right.
All right, anyway. So takeaways from this game, I think that there are two main ones in my head on offense. One is, I know it's just the first game against Western Michigan, but it looks for like the nth straight year. We talked a lot about reading guys, mm-hmm. and we're not doing that at all. so that's kind of the negative takeaway. The positive takeaway is I think Blake Corum is the chosen one. He is the man who has come to fulfill the prophecy of being Mike Hart, but fast.
if we could describe him any other way, there's no other way to describe him.
The way he cuts is exactly like Mike Hart cuts. He's the same little ball of muscle. He takes contact and it doesn't go down immediately. You know, he gets that extra 2 yards by falling forward every time because he's so low to the ground, he's so strong. And his ability to play in space is beyond Hart's because he is actually really fast. So, you know, that swing pass on the first drive, as soon as they threw that, I went Matt Millen with Denard in my head. Where there's that game against UConn where Matt Millen, like, as soon as Denard stepped forward, Millen was like, that's six. And in my head, I'm like, touchdown, before the ball had been thrown, and indeed, low it was. So I'm super hype about Blake Corum to the point where Zach Charbonnet can destroy Clemson. Was it Clemson? No, it wasn't Clemson. Who'd they play?
LSU.
LSU. They can destroy LSU, and I'm like, good for him. I'm not mad about that. So I am like on the Blake Corum hype train.
It's impossible not to. He also had that the kick return. And a couple of those, like the blocks were not great on that kick return. He just set them up by like, you know, zooming through. So that acceleration he has.
Save that for the kick return segment, man.
And you saw it a couple times in his play where there were plays where you like, okay, that running back might be trapped or like that defensive tackle squeezing that hole and Corum just like jets through it. And,
well, he put a linebacker, an unblocked linebacker, on his ass with a cut.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that is going to make him more than just a workhorse. And I like Hassan Haskins, don't get me wrong, but that's what he is. Hassan Haskins is a workhorse. And Blake Corum, I think, can be much more than that.
I would give Haskins more credit than a workhorse because he put a couple guys wrong-footed, and he like they delivered a lot of guys to Hassan Haskins at the line of scrimmage, and he still managed to bust through them. He still managed to, set up a couple blocks right before he cut right through them. And I mean, that's a part of the Charbonnet equation too. Is that like Haskins looks for like really freaking good, and you know I would not trade any of these guys. And then when you bring in Donovan Edwards as your third guy, and there were like a lot of moments there because once again they were delivering guys to him at the line of scrimmage that he was having to cut away from, and he made yards that were not on the field. And I think every single running back on this team, Corum number one, I don't think that's in doubt. But every running back on this team is making yards beyond what the line delivered him almost every play.
Yeah, this game really showed the value of having good running backs, right? Like, yes, offensive line play is a big part of your rushing game, but having running backs who can grind out those extra yards, the patience they showed, the strength they showed, you know, there wasn't a ton of push. There weren't a lot of gaping holes, but it was still an effective ground attack really off the backs of your two dudes.
Yeah, and it got more effective after the Bell touchdown. And then there was the other deep shot that got called back. So before that, you have a pretty much no read run game in which, you know, you're going up against rolled up safeties who are really tight to the line of scrimmage. And after Michigan hit a couple deep shots, Western decided that they couldn't keep risking that. And that's when you really saw things open up. So that remains a concern for teams that are going to be able to be more aggressive with their safeties because they have better secondary. I don't know if that includes Washington anymore.
We'll get to them.
You know, kind of overall, I was not super impressed with the offensive design, you know, and we have seen Michigan. I mean, we saw a game in which Michigan was never really threatened after the first drive for Michigan, for Western. So it's possible that there's more stuff in it, but it didn't look like something where they had really emphasized RPOs or really emphasize any sort of mesh point reads in the run game, because those are the kind of things that you would run a lot in this game just for the live action reps, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not something that you would hide. That's something that you would have in the game just so that you would have some film that you could go back and talk to these guys about. So I mean,
kind
of feel like it's still in the Patterson Milton zone where you're wondering if this is really going to look like a modern offense, and the answer might be no.
I mean, that was a problem that we talked about all offseason, wasn't it? Reading the wrong guy. Or one time he was actually reading one side of the line and they were not blocking a guy on the other side of the line. And like, that's design, right? They're designing it this way.
I mean, I honestly don't know if there were any post snap reads. It's possible, but there were those times where you're like, oh, he's going to keep the ball. And then he never ever keeps the ball on instances where it seems like, oh, that's the opportunity to do it. Then I kind of feel like that's not part of their game plan.
Yeah. I mean, I'll defer to you guys on the read component. The one thing I was encouraged about just in general was the ability to get some of the playmakers outside, testing the edges of the defense and just using some of the players on the team effectively. Like, Harbaugh's offenses have rarely been big play offenses that could really strike you. And this game, you had a lot of 50 plus yard plays that you don't normally have. And a lot of it was just using the guys on the roster. So that was one thing I was encouraged about, was, the Henning end around, using Roman Wilson when he ripped off that, whatever it was, 40, 50 yard play. Just getting to see those guys in flashes was something I did enjoy from the offensive standpoint.
Yeah, and the Henning end around, we have to give a hat tip to Haskins, because he was the guy who got the block way downfield that was like the last guy. And then Henning's speed was able to beat another guy to the corner. And you're like, all right, how do we use this guy more? And the answer might be, put in J.J. McCarthy, because J.J. McCarthy loves A.J. Henning. And I think his first three or four passes went to Henning.
Yeah.
At least were in the vicinity of Henning.
And the first first of them was like that, like, we just shot right out of a cannon right at him. Remind me of that Shane Morris first pass. We're like, oh, look at that arm. Not making the comparison between Shane Morris, but
why?
Reminded me of that Drew Henson pass the first time when you saw it too. We'll get back to Drew Henson later, because there was more Drew Henson-y. I just want to go back real quick and shout out Andrew Vastardis on that that run for Henning too, because he got out there, and that was a center getting out there and knocking down a linebacker.
I'd also like to shout out Mike Sainristil still. I noticed a couple great blocks from him on some of those plays. I know on the first Corum touchdown, I noted him on the edge. The team talked about more physical blocking from the wide receivers in camp, and at least from him, that seemed to show up.
Yeah, the play before A.J. Henning's touchdown, actually, Sainristil still blocked two guys. Like, he took a guy to the sidelines, and it's like, okay, you're done, and then just moved on down.
Yeah, it's one thing when Khalid Hill is doing that, too. It's another thing when a slot receiver. That's not good. Just from a Western Michigan perspective, that's foreboding.
Yeah, this is not a... I mean, considering how badly Michigan players just beat up on Western Michigan players, this would not be... For the first game back after playing all back last year, I would be a little concerned if I'm a Broncos fan.
All right, now we can talk about it. The throw that shook the foundations of college football. J.J. McCarthy. Pressured, rolls out, sets up at one sideline, throws across not one hash, but both hashes to Daylon Baldwin, who this ball actually was coming kind of towards me in the stands, and I was like, all right, shoot your shot, it's third and long, whatever. And he comes back the other way, I'm like, that's interesting. And then Baldwin sort of separates from the defensive back, who doesn't understand what's happening. I was impressed that Baldwin understood what was happening and just sort of like smoothly disengaged, made a catch, ran for a touchdown. That's not something you see real often. This guy sort of setting up on his back foot, getting wasted by three different guys and throwing a 50-yard dart.
Yeah, I mean, Baldwin comes in because, I mean, he's been playing in the SWAC, and he's, you know, he's expecting if a quarterback's going to put it anywhere, he's just going to try to chuck it up, you know, 30 yards downfield in the middle. And then he sees the, where it's actually going, and that's how he gets the separation. And the cornerback has, like, no concept that this is even possible. Like, this cornerback has never faced a throw that's going to go from the opposite sideline to the opposite sideline. I think Orlovsky said 50 yards, and Ace this morning, like, did the math. He, like, pulled out the Pythagorean theorem and, like, showed where it was thrown and where it got to. And he was like, yeah, that's about 49, 50 yards.
It just really reminded me, when I watched that play happen, it reminded me of, like, the 2011 to 2013 era Matthew Stafford plays where he's just, like, rolling out and just heaving it. Like, that was so much of the Lions' offense of, like, my early, you know, years in the early 2010s. And, like, you got an arm if you can make that play, and you got talent if you can make that play, and it just oozed off the screen. So shout out to JJ.
Yes. So Alex, because you weren't around for this, and everyone thinks we were crazy, that is why we all liked Henson so much. Like, when you go back and, like, why did Michigan fans want Henson and not Tom Brady? It's because, like, if you go back and watch, like, the Syracuse game.
Speak for yourself.
I'm speaking for the fan base, because people wanted Henson, and because he would make those throws. He made that throw against Ohio State one time, and that was the Henson special right there.
Yeah, but I think that did showcase some of the stuff we heard in camp, right? Like, one week it would be JJ's going to catch Cade, and the next week it was like, oh, it's not close. And I think it's just that, you know, Cade is more consistent on a down-to-down basis, but JJ does stuff like that makes you be like, whoa, like, this guy, you know, the ceiling is so much higher, and just, you know, that seemed evident there.
So we got a lot of Joel Honigford early as a tight end, who's still pretty much a bonus OL, even though he's officially a tight end this year. And we saw Schoonmaker, and I think that was...
No, they had one throw to the walk-on.
Seltzer.
Yeah. Seltzer.
So we should mention that most of McCarthy's throws, other than the, like, eye-popping one, were not on point. He threw behind guys a lot, so there are a couple of drops from Henning that weren't really drops because they were well behind him. He's going to get a lot of MAs when you do this UFR.
Yeah.
Or straight-up INs, depending on how generous you feel. So that inconsistency that Alex is talking about was also on display. So, have anything else for the offense, guys?
Somebody does. I'd just like to say that we got to see the Villari cat. I was laughed at mentioning that on the preview.
It went about as well as we expected.
if you're only gonna do reads with Villari, I mean, why not even start that guy? Because, like, hey, you know, it works. That offense works. The thing that bothered me was their play action did not really open up anything, and it was because the play action that they were playing was not reading one of the guys. So there was always some defensive tackle or some defensive end getting into the backfield, so the quarterback would never have time to throw before. It was like the weirdest play action I've ever seen, because it's already delivering a guy to the backfield.
Well, we'll have to see if that continues. We're going to take a break, come back, talk about the defense.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting U of M apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing in one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com. It's painless. It's online. It's group ordering made easy for your next custom printed apparel order. Pogo from Underground Printing will save you time and hassle. Whether you're selling shirts for a fundraiser, organizing a large event, trying to collect sizes and payments for a family reunion, or, you know, ordering a whole bunch of shirts with your Kickstarter, Underground Printing is here to help. Save time and hassle every step of the way with their easy-to-use site. No more guessing what to order, chasing people down to pay, wasting time trying to sort out the order. They'll set it up, you can just sit back and relax. They'll even take care of individual shipping. To learn more about Pogo, visit them at any of their convenient locations or at pogo.undergroundshirt.com.
Hey, so I have, like, insurance and stuff, but I don't really, like, know what's going on with it.
Yeah, your coverage probably sucks, and you're paying way too much for it. And I know this because I had a guy, his name's Phil Klein. He's actually a Michigan alum and wrestled for Michigan. He okay. looked at my insurance, and he was like, yeah, your coverage sucks, and you're paying a lot more than you need to for it.
I also, like, I hesitate to even mention this, but I do have my insurance from a company that advertises during college football games. Well, and I wish that was not the case.
Well, why don't you just get it from a cool guy who actually, like, reads MGo Blog?
Well, how would I do that? They have a website?
They have one of those, too. It's philklineinsurance.com. Can you remember the name Phil Klein?
Sure.
Can you remember insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Use those two together, and you will save money on your insurance, and you will actually get better coverage on your home and your auto, and they do life, too.
All right. So you're telling me if I Google Phil Klein Insurance, this website will come up?
Yes.
Wonders never cease.
During these challenging times, it is important to have a Michigan man in your corner. If you or someone in your life has questions, concerns, or just want to discuss your legal rights, give attorney Jonathan Paul a call at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com. John asks you all to be safe. We're going to get through this together. And as always, go blue.
At Peak Wealth, we believe we can help you retire with confidence. It's Nick Hopwood, certified financial planner from
Peak Wealth Management
in Plymouth. I graduated from Michigan in 2001 with an econ degree and founded Peak Wealth Management in 2014. Now we have over $240 million of assets under management. As a freshman in 97, winning the national championship in football and hockey didn't get any better than that. Both my wife and I lived in Bursley that year, and it's crazy because we never actually met while living in the same dorm. Probably because she had a car and I had to ride the bus. But we named our dog Bursley anyway, and he's on the payroll here at Peak Wealth Management. At Peak, we're fee-based. We're your fiduciary, which means everything we recommend is always in your best interest. We partner with leading institutional money managers, focus on low fees, and make sure every client has a financial plan covering retirement, college, tax, estate, insurance, and cash flow. Simply put, we are
Peak Wealth Management,
your comprehensive financial coach. Book your second opinion at peakwm.com/mgoblog.
Peak Wealth Management.
Retire with confidence.
Welcome back to the MGo podcast. Michigan faces the Western Michigan Broncos and immediately gives up a long touchdown drive featuring a heavily contested chunk catch and then a bunch of stuff in the flats. And I think everybody was like, uh-oh, here we go. And then Mike McDonald adjusted, stopped playing so much cover three, and Western Michigan didn't score again until garbage time. So encouraging. You know, I think things mostly went well here. As Seth predicted, we saw a defense that was base nickel that had Dax Hill as their space backer. And Hill really gave off Peppers vibes whenever Western Michigan tried to do anything in terms of a screen to the wide side of the field. That just wasn't happening. He was blowing up blocks, getting off blocks, and if he didn't make the play himself, he was disrupting it enough so that someone else could come in and Western would get nothing. And that's a really good thing to see. Honestly, you know, we talk about the Viper position, and the Viper position was more of a linebacker. It wasn't a guy who you wanted carrying someone down the slot necessarily. We had some issues with that over the course of Don Brown's career. And Dax Hill looks like he can be a real deal full-time space backer because, I mean, base nickel is going to be what it is against everybody except, what, Wisconsin?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Northwestern, so, maybe.
The shape of the defense doesn't look a whole lot different than last year, except the ends are standing up, which I still hate. But the amount of coverage that they can throw at people has gone up a lot because, one, their safeties coach is coaching, so that's always good. And, two, they have a much more diverse set of zone schemes that they've actually practiced.
Yeah, and there was a big difference between Dax Hill and the other safeties whenever they were putting some sort of run support, in addition to the three screens that they tried, and also that PBU where I thought he was out of position. I was just like ready for that safety to give up inside, and all of a sudden, like doink, and that's Dax. I don't even remember Peppers doing that very much.
People didn't really go at Peppers because they had much better options elsewhere.
I think my overarching take on the defense overall is that I'm fascinated for the UFR because just watching the game in real time and then watching even on replay, how many bodies were rotated, especially on the defensive front. I mean, we talked about only a few guys at defensive tackle in the preview, but I mean, we saw, you know, Chris Jenkins out there, Mike Morris was out there. It was just kind of this constant rotation of bodies on the interior and on the edges. And it was, that was definitely something I wasn't quite expecting, but was definitely interesting to note.
Yeah, and Western's ground game got, I think, one kind of chunk play, but the rest of it was just kind of grinding out near the line. And if they got 4 or 5 yards, that was unusual. So, you know, that doesn't necessarily prove a whole lot, but there were scenarios here where Michigan just got gashed by a MAC team, and it was going to be that kind of year. And we didn't see that yet. We're not out of the woods in terms of defensive tackle in any way whatsoever, but it did seem like they had a number of at least reasonable options, and at least we can go into the Washington game with that still an open question instead of this is Chernobyl.
Yeah, and I was more impressed with Hinton than I thought I would be. Like, a lot of times I would look back and you'd pause it, and the defensive tackle in the backfield would be Hinton, and the defensive tackle who got shoved down a few yards was, you know, the other guy, and the other guy was rotating all the time. So I was pleasantly surprised after hearing negative things about him in practice that Hinton looked like probably Michigan's best player at that defensive tackle, those two non-nose tackle positions.
Yeah, I thought he looked sharp, and I thought Mike Morris had a few plays of note. Mm-hmm. The other guys didn't really stand out as much to me, but yeah, I mean, they didn't get blown up, and they, you know, it wasn't apocalyptic, and that's always a good start.
Yeah, Morris was the guy who made first contact on a third and shortstop. That was a pretty big play kind of early in the game when we were still wondering about whether Western Michigan was actually going to put up a bunch of points. And he was playing that stand-up spot too, so he's rotating in with the ends. That's one thing that did surprise me, is that Hutchinson came off the field a lot. And I feel like that's probably not going to be the case next week. So, you know, maybe their philosophy was just, we're going to get a lot of guys snaps in this game. I can't imagine that Hutchinson isn't going to get the lion's share in games against Power 5 teams. But he was off the field a lot. A lot less rotation at linebacker. We saw Nikai Hill Green come in and stick a couple guys. He also kind of got worked once in space. Seemed like Junior Colson might be the only other guy they're rotating in there. Did you see
not until the end? They had Michael Barrett in there later, but are we counting the outside linebackers as linebackers? Like,
no, because they're stand-up defensive ends.
Because David Ojabo was in this game.
Ojabo and Hutchinson, yeah. Those are not linebackers.
No, but Ojabo was like the guy that they chose to go at in this game. And they were hitting right after halftime. They were getting outside of him a lot. And I thought I was more concerned about Ojabo's play than I was either of the linebackers. I think the two chunk plays, one of them was Nikai Hill Green just missed a tackle and Josh Ross went in the wrong gap. And those are like the only two times I saw the linebackers really mess something up. Nikai Hill Green missed, he got sucked in by play action too. That was it.
I believe we did see Khalil Mullings once the match was right. Not at any point when the game is competitive.
Yeah, there were a couple of hits kind of in the middle of the field where the linebackers were out of position in zone stuff, particularly early. And then there's one later that turned into a drop. So that might be a little bit of a concern that there were some spots in the middle of the field that felt like the zone drops weren't particularly good. At cornerback, Vincent Gray had a pretty good game. And obviously, this is going to be a judgment withheld scenario until we see Gray against some higher level players. But that's encouraging. You know, I think Jamon Green proved last year that he's at least a solid Big Ten cornerback. And I don't really blame him very much for the chunk play that Western got against him, because that was like a freshman Jordan Lewis kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Where he's right there, his hand's right there. It just barely goes over his hand. Like, that's going to happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, so, there's a difference between like being in position, but like having your face turn and trying to like swipe it out, and actually having the time to turn around in a shuriken. Like, that guy is no more under blame than the Florida State guy who gave up the winning touchdown to Notre Dame last night. Like, that was just that's just going to happen. That's going to happen to you. It's not really your fault.
I mean, when there was completions, it was generally the 7 yard out, you know, in the zone. I mean, there weren't a lot of guys getting toasted. They had one or two deep shots against Gray, one of which there was some tugging going on that he probably got away with. The other one just went over the head of the receiver. I mean,
yeah, there was one where I saw that come out and it was like, no, 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 no. And then the receiver dropped the ball and Gray started celebrating like he had done something when I'm not entirely sure.
On replay, he absolutely did not do something.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I mean, Gray is way more comfortable in cover two, though. He did have that come up and stick that Ojabo wiped out by going and taunting the guy afterwards.
Yeah.
But like, that was a great cornerback play, and there was another opportunity for Green to make that play and missed it. He sat back and didn't come down, and I think the guy dropped it, but he was like wide open underneath. So Green's cover two stuff is a little...
I still have major concerns about the secondary sort of in general. The structure of it seems fine, and if they're running more zone, I think they'll be less exposed. Like, I don't think we have, two man-to-man corners. I think Jamon Green is one. But the structure of the defense should be better for the personnel this year, but I still think that they're pretty vulnerable. And I think a lack of pass rush is a potential complaint here. I know Hutchinson had that sack strip where I don't know what the offensive tackle was thinking on that play. he didn't even extend his arms. I don't know what he thought was going to happen.
I mean, Hutchinson did that a few times to that poor guy. So
yeah, other than that, I felt like Western had too much time in the pocket quite a lot. And so that is a concern. And they weren't just, you know, they weren't doing the MTSU, everything's a dink, you can't get to the quarterback thing. Like, Ellaby was going through 2-3 reads on some of these plays before coming down to the flats or whatever. So I'm not... Part of that may be that Aiden Hutchinson rotated out a lot, and that's your best pass rusher. But I was hoping to see a little bit more from Ojabo in terms of, like, yeah, I'm on the field, I'm a complete freak, and nobody can get me around the corner.
Yeah, it felt like the pass rush was more kind of a, we're just going to compress you down until you die kind of style of pass rush. And a lot of times when they probably would have gotten sacks against another quarterback, I mean, I just think that... Western Michigan was really good at getting the ball out and throwing it at someone. If you're charting them, there are at least 6 or 7 plays that are just complete throwaways. And like, a lot of times we went and looked down the field because the cornerback was in position, but the ball went nowhere near him. And that was, you know, so that told me that the pass rush is getting there in time. And then there were also, when I was doing a rewatch last night, I don't want to like ref blame here, because this is just going to happen in any game, but there were a lot of plays where someone actually got really close to the quarterback and then just got that last yank back and he got the ball out. So I think Ojabo actually was kind of generating pressure. He didn't get any sacks out of it, but he was getting into the backfield pretty regularly. Hutchinson got out of the backfield regularly. The tackles did not. And that's kind of where I think there was room to step up and make those throws sometimes. where like that's not supposed to happen. Those defensive tackles have to get that pocket pushed in order to pay off those blitzes or those attacks.
The first quarter was pretty disappointing from a pass rush standpoint, but I thought that as the game went along, they started to get home a little bit more and bother Ellaby more. And there were a few plays where guys were open and the pass was just off the mark, in part because the pressure was coming. So I don't know. We'll see upon further review, obviously, but it got better as the game went on was my take on it.
All right. Any more defensive takes, guys?
Nope. I got the weird that Brad Hawkins used to be a receiver because there's another interception that he dropped.
That's not a drop. He's coming up and he's focused on the receiver, and then all of a sudden the ball's on him. That's different.
Sure.
All right, we're going to take a break, come back, talk some special teams, and there's no game theory in this one, but whatever.
Hey, it's Nick Hopwood, founder and president at Peak Wealth Management. We have a lot in common. We both went to Michigan. We're both huge fans, but I'm concerned about how much time you're spending on Michigan football recruiting. This could be time spent with me poring over your cash flow and Roth conversion strategy. How are these Roth conversions going to get done with you spending all your time and energy on MGoBlog looking at the next five-star recruits? Hey, all kidding aside, if you're addicted to MGoBlog and you want to outsource some of your financial planning to an expert, consider us, peakwm.com/MGoBlog. At Peak, we work with people in a variety of situations. Some of our clients are young professionals looking to optimize their savings and investments. For young people, time is the key. Some of our clients are super affluent trying to figure out when they can retire. Some are high net worth retirees looking for a second opinion on how their money's working for them. Get your second opinion at peakwm.com/mgoblog.
Peak Wealth Management.
Retire with confidence.
It can be a rough ride along the information superhighway. That's why we build our e-commerce websites tough enough to handle the load. With the capacity to take hundreds of simultaneous online transactions and the stability of load-balanced, co-located server architectures, a website from Human Element performs in the roughest conditions. Thousands of products? No problem. We'll throw in the tools to manage them with precision and efficiency. All with a design slick enough to make you think your girlfriend might be impressed. So load it up and hit the gas and let Human Element show you the way. Special offers available for returning lessees. Financing available with approved credit to qualified buyers. Client participation may affect savings. Optional equipment available at additional cost. See human-element.com for details.
It's painless. It's online. It's group ordering made easy for your next custom printed apparel order. Pogo from Underground Printing will save you time and hassle. Whether you're selling shirts for a fundraiser, organizing a large event, trying to collect sizes and payments for a family reunion, or, you know, ordering a whole bunch of shirts with your Kickstarter, Underground Printing is here to help. Save time and hassle every step of the way with their easy-to-use site. No more guessing what to order, chasing people down to pay, wasting time trying to sort out the order. They'll set it up. You can just sit back and relax. They'll even take care of individual shipping. To learn more about Pogo, visit them at any of their convenient locations or at pogo.undergroundshirts.com. If you want to see where our post-game podcast happens, or if you need a spot to land in Ann Arbor, check out 4M, Prentice Partners' beautiful brand-new flagship property at 830 Henry Street in Lower Burns Park and across the bridge from the Big House. Their 11 spacious 6-bedroom, 6-bath suites feature state-of-the-art digital capabilities and are laid out for comfortable, efficient collaboration. You can also rent a 4M unit for shorter stays, say if you want to come to town for a football weekend. I want to add myself that they're also taking over Lucky's. We're really excited about their plans for that space. So if you're by the stadium, swing by 830 Henry or visit Prentice4M.com.
So we forgot to do the hot take, and I'm currently in a car driving away from Nashville. Please forgive any excessively hot takes driven by friction on the road. I don't know. Seth! Alex! I need your rawest takes! Seth, give me your rawest take! A take so raw, it could be raw!
We're in season form, Brian, and I'm going to say that...
This the worst one ever.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Michigan should have started Dan Villari! Because he's the only guy who's actually running their offense. And it's not like they really passed very much. So, I mean, it would have been a...
Do you know who PFF's number one ranked quarterback nationally was this week?
It's Cade McNamara.
It's Cade McNamara. So that is a very raw take. Possibly too raw for anything. Alex, give me your rawest take.
Iowa is going to win 11 games this year.
Okay. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Like, it's Iowa. They're definitely going to lose to, like, Minnesota, I want to say. Maybe Northwestern. Maybe you're right. I don't know.
So here's what Iowa says. They absolutely beat down on Indiana, played really good defense, contained Penix, forced turnovers, stopped the running game, and, like, they win like 8 games a year, except like once every 6 years where they win like 10 or 11. And the last one was 2015. So we're about due for that Kirk Ferentz goes to a, you know, New Year's 6 game type year. So
I'm all in on the contract year. He does that in his contract years.
Yeah, but I don't know. I was
literally
sold.
Everybody else in the West looks terrible.
Right.
Illinois lost. Nebraska's Nebraska. Northwestern looks terrible. Wisconsin, their quarterback looks terrible. And then Jack Coat.
Yeah.
Pretty good. So that's a bummer for the Badgers, I guess. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that is somewhat feasible. All right, here's my Michigan's going 9-3, which is a 2-game improvement from my preseason prediction. And that's based on a win over the MAC Western Michigan Broncos. So that I think that's fairly raw. I'm basing this mostly on the fact that, yes, Wisconsin looks terrible. Yes, Washington looks terrible. Yes, Indiana does not look particularly interesting. I mean, Maryland did win. Rutgers won, but, like, they won with, like, I think 40 passing yards from Noah Vedral. That doesn't really move the needle. Like, I think we saw enough good things out of Michigan in the opener to, like, be a little bit less concerned about a number of things we were concerned about. Like, I think Blake Corum's the truth, and I think the schedule is not nearly as hard as people were expecting it.
Oh, see, I was already at 7-5, not respecting the schedule very much. Like, I don't imagine Michigan goes into Wisconsin and doesn't read anybody on the offense, on the defensive line, and then, you know, moves the ball against those guys.
Well, I mean, you hear it here, folks. Brian is the optimistic one, and Seth is the pessimistic one.
This doesn't mean I'm back into college football. That's not what it means.
Did you not watch the Notre Dame game, the Notre Dame FSU? Because, like, that all of my talk over the off season about not caring as much about college football is just over after that one.
No, I turned on like the last 10 minutes of it, I guess, because it took a while to get back to our hotel room after the soccer game, so it was we didn't have that option, but it was okay. Like, Mackenzie Milton would throw a screen pass, and everybody would be like, oh, my God! I was like, all right, it was a little bit over the top.
Who he's throwing the screen passes to, man. Like, you know, Notre Dame's defense was terrible. Jack Cohn is slinging it. Like, that was a good game.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying. I don't want to, like, put my emotional well-being out there for college football.
So
I gotta turtle up, yo.
So Michigan going 9-3 is your hot take, but you're not ready to say I'm into college football.
Well, I mean, Michigan going 9-3 and, like, getting boat raced by Ohio State, which is still my prediction, doesn't, like, it's not amazing, right? I don't know. Hey, this segment is supposedly sponsored, isn't it?
If you would like us to continue doing this extremely silly segment, check out Raw Power for iOS and Mac. It's an advanced photo editor and manager, and Raw Power is written by a Michigan alum. It's great with RAWs and JPEGs, works with your Apple library, and adds editing features no other app has. Raw Power is 20% off, still for the next few hours, I think, by the time you're listening to this. So get on that. Check it out at rawpower.app. And with that, we're going to the part that we actually recorded, which is Brian talking about special teams.
there was a lot of special teams. So Michigan gets a big punt return that gets Ronnie Bell injured. Michigan gets a big kickoff return. Their prehistoric punting formation does not matter because Brad Robbins is skying them so high that there's like, you can read a book as a punt returner before like fair catching. So that was encouraging. Hit a field goal, a couple field goals. That was encouraging. And then we saw one of those old style Kalik Hudson couldn't quite block a punt because we overran it.
Yep.
Incidents where the guy gets through and you're like, how did he not, one, touch the ball, and two, run over the punter? Neither of those things happened, but it looks like for, I think, the fourth or fifth straight year, Michigan's going to have some special teams units that are among the best in the country.
Yep. And I mean, the hilarity of like the boring time when everyone's waiting for the punt to come down because we've already fair caught and we've already like everyone's gotten down there. It's just brilliant. And then like Moody put his that early kick. That one was so high I couldn't tell if it was in or not because it was just like 20 feet over the uprights.
Yeah, and I don't think any of his kickoffs were returned, right?
No. One? Well, yeah, they put one at the he fogged one.
Oh yeah, there were a couple that didn't even get out to the 25. So good coverage, good hang time on the kicks. So I don't think there's anything to complain about special teams. And I think the punt thing where they showed once again that they have this punt downloaded and they can go get it, even if they manage to not hit the ball this time. I think that's really encouraging too, because this was supposed to be like a Baxter thing.
Yeah.
Baxter was here for 1 year and we're like, all right, is this our Wiley Coyote year? It's like, no, it's not. This is just what Jay Harbaugh has set up. So super encouraging. And I think that given the fact that we've had these kind of special teams heroics for the past few years, I think we can expect that to continue.
It's kind of annoying that like we get, because we got into the backfield twice on those. And one of them, like you said, the guy just like flew past without even without even affecting the punt. And the second one, the punter was able to like flop on the ground and pick up a 5-yard call. And I mean, it was late in the game. We didn't really care at that point, but you know, that guy had been watching Iowa film, which, okay, punters watch Iowa film. That makes sense.
Michigan also blocked a field goal in this game.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
So they did, I think, literally everything good that you can do on special teams, except actually block a punt. And they came really, really close. So good stuff. This is a short segment.
Well, what do we think about the end of the half sequence?
Yeah, that's what I want to get to.
Well, okay, so they're up 24-7 at that point. They got a 4th-and-1 on the 2. So I do have some problems with the clock management once you get under a minute. Like there's got to be a throw in there just so you get all your downs. But the decision to kick the field goal once you're in 4th-and-1 is different at the end of the half, because one of the big advantages of going for it down there is if you fail, they've got the ball on the 2. That pushes more towards field goal. And then the fact that you're favored, you're playing a MAC team, you're already up 17. You, in that point, you're the team that wants low variance. And so the field goal is low variance. So I was fine with the decision to kick the field goal right there. Just because of the shape of the game and all that stuff. That made a lot of sense. The clock management to kind of get down to that point. I mean, I guess they did get all their downs in because it was 4th down. You can question the play calling. You can question the decision. But I guess once you get to like 4th-and-1 from the 2 on a late half drive, you can't really complain about the clock management stuff that got you there, is my take.
It just felt a little disappointing kicking the field goal, just because that drive, the offensive line was so good. They were just marching down the field. They got to 1st and 10 on the 11-yard line with 40 seconds left and all 3 timeouts. And it just kind of felt like, you know, we're going to march it in, punch it in, get another touchdown before half. And they get 7 yards on 1st down, take a timeout, and then it just kind of stalls. And so I think the segment of the fan base wanted to go for it because we had already in our heads been like, yeah, we're getting a touchdown this drive. And then
are you saying that we should have put the Valari cat out there?
I don't know what the call should have been, but just I think from an emotional standpoint, people were upset just because it felt like, I don't know, the drive was going so well that it was like, oh, I guess we have to kick the field goal now.
Yeah, it was 3 runs. They only had one timeout, I think, when they got there. But they were, there was run, run, run. And one of the runs was Corum, I think, breaking a tackle to turn like a loss into a 7-yard gain or an 8-yard gain to get them to that 4th and 2 anyway.
Mike Hart.
Yes. but I mean, you, as far as play calling is concerned, you can't, you have to have stuff practiced for that. Like, if you're getting down with no time left, you should not be just running your regular plays and only get 3 plays in with 40 seconds and a timeout. You should have stuff called. And like a no read run up the middle, where you know they're going to be crashing on the running back. Like, that's insane to me. How do you not have something practiced in that situation? Because, like, they play this. They're supposed to do this at the end of practice. Like, okay, 2 minutes left. And they don't actually have any plays that they practice for these situations.
I don't know. To me, getting bent out of shape about the end of the first half would be a little performative. Like, it's just the situation was unfortunate that they couldn't punch it in, but that was what happened. And they got their plays in and they got their field goal. And it's like, ah, it's fine.
Yeah. Right?
It's fine.
All right. We have to shout out Samer Still for his blocking on special teams, by the way. Like, I know we talked about that earlier, but like, you made me wait for the special teams section, so I waited.
Right.
Samer Still, okay. That was some awesome blocking, man. I'm really excited about this guy.
All right. So we're going to take a break. I'm going to get on the road. So the JV section will be led by Seth, and I want you guys to enjoy it.
This is Matt Demrest, the owner of Homesure Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homesure Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our complicated loan. Brian used them, you should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homesurelending.com. That's HOMESURE lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
It's painless. It's online. It's group ordering made easy for your next custom printed apparel order. Pogo from Underground Printing will save you time and hassle. Whether you're selling shirts for a fundraiser, organizing a large event, or trying to collect sizes and payment for a family reunion, UGP is here to help. Save time and hassle every step of the way with our easy-to-use site. No more guessing what to order, chasing down people to pay, or wasting time trying to sort out the order. We'll set it up and you can just sit back and relax. We can even take care of individual shipping. To learn more about Pogo, visit us at any of our convenient locations or at pogo.undergroundshirts.com. In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages
approximately $100,000.
It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Nothing else matters.
So we lost Brian. He's off to Nashville, but we welcome in Jamie Mack. It's been a long time, man. We actually get some football to talk about again.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's good to see you too.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've got quite a bit to talk about because not only do we have, you know, football preseason, so it's not just Big Ten teams playing each other, but they all play. But now we're part of the Big Alliance, so we have to talk about everything, right? Like, this is our conference now.
Right. Right, we're going to run through all 41 teams in the Alliance, everybody, so pour a cup of coffee and sit back.
That's,
oh, wait, maybe we're not going to do that.
Well, I would talk about Florida State and Notre Dame, but I think we can skip that one. But we definitely have to talk about Washington versus Montana, right?
Yeah. We could quickly say that Brian Kelly is still an ass. We can still say that.
He is, and they so
then we can move on to Washington.
They deserve to lose that game, but...
Memo to Graham Mertz.
We're going to get to him, but I want to talk about Washington with Montana. What happened? What happened here? How did Montana beat Washington, other than the fact that Bob Stitt was their coach in 2017 and probably recruited all their players?
It seems like a lot of sloppiness from Washington. Also, they only scored 7 points. You know, in the past, it seems like every time an FCS school takes down an FBS or a Power Five, there's an element of a shootout. You know, there's a couple of guys you can't stop, and it gets out of control. But to see a Pac-12 power only score 7 points and lose a defensive battle to an FCS team is a little off-putting. And Washington scored on their first drive and didn't score again.
Yeah, well, also Dylan Morris had 0 touchdowns to 3 interceptions, and Montana did not turn the ball over. So, you know, that right there is a good recipe for an FCS upset.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the 5 factors showing up big time.
And also, Morris had 4.9 yards per attempt on 46 pass attempts.
He sounds like he's ready for the Big Ten.
I mean, they just played against Giles Jackson, who dropped like a crucial fourth down attempt in this game. So, I mean, they were running him outside. They were making him part of it. But, I mean, I didn't get to watch the whole game. I got to watch like a fairly comprehensive highlights package that lasts about 15 minutes. And it looked like the John Donovan effect maybe didn't come in last year, but is coming in this year. Do you remember John Donovan, the Penn State offensive coordinator, who like gave Michigan two games? And yes. So, I mean, they're doing the same stuff. They're putting 2 tight ends on either side of the line. They're kind of bringing everybody in. And that is, you know, the way to beat John Donovan is just blitz your safeties and use the fact that they have that he's giving you extra guys in the box to attack. And I mean, they were doing things like running duo without checking to make sure the extra linebacker is not in there, and actually not having the running back even read the linebacker. So John Donovan, everybody, maybe Washington is terrible now.
Yeah. Well, two thoughts on that. One, hey, the strength of Michigan's defense is their safeties, so that's good. And two, it sounds like Washington's going to have to spend a lot of time this week kind of correcting their own mistakes and maybe less time preparing for Michigan. So that could be a preparation advantage going into next Saturday.
So you think this is going to help, or is it going to hurt that Washington now is like angry, coming off a big, you know, they need to like reshape themselves? You know, you don't think that maybe like if they just crush these guys that they'd feel a little bit more confident?
Well, I mean, you know, you kind of detailed kind of the offensive mistakes they made, and Alex pointed out the interceptions. I mean, I just think they, you know, when they go into the film room, they've got to do a lot of correcting. And yeah, you know, usually you're beating Montana by like 4 or 5 touchdowns and you can focus on your next opponent. So, you know, in that regard, you know, they could have a choppy week of preparation. One caveat I would offer is that typically teams that get upset as a double digit favorite, meaning they're favored by double digits and they lose the game outright, typically they come back the next game and cover pretty frequently as a road underdog. I know a lot of professional gamblers kind of love that system. So that is something to worry about. I know that over the years on this podcast, I have raised that alarm bell before, and it's never materialized in the Michigan game. So,
well, that's because
this is something that they might that usually the underdogs cover about two out of every three times after they get upset the week before. And in this case, the point spread all summer was Michigan minus one, and
right.
it has been changed now to Michigan minus six. So people who are betting the game this week have to lay 6 points with Michigan after Washington laid the egg.
I mean, I can see where that would come from, because after a big loss, and we've certainly experienced a few of those ourselves, there's mm-hmm. a massive over-adjustment from the fans, right? It's like,
yep.
oh my God, you right. lost to an FCS team. Everything else just goes out the window. It's just that fact. And mm-hmm. because they're in the news, I think sometimes the numbers that the bettors look at are not necessarily what the line is, because the line is what the market's at, right? So the market is
exactly,
out there saying,
exactly.
I saw that Washington lost to Montana. These guys are terrible. Where they're really the same team that they were last week, and your opinion doesn't have to change that much. What I think we also see sometimes, yeah. though, are teams that give up. And I don't know where you can put that in your gambling, you know, things, but like, how much does Washington's season ruined now? Because I mean, we've seen Michigan, and I don't need to bring up the obvious examples, but we've seen Michigan lose right. Games that they absolutely were not supposed to lose, and then the next game is just like a post-apocalyptic destruction at the hands of Oregon or something.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I know. I agree. It'll be interesting to see which way Washington goes. I never got a beat on this team last year or any of the Pac-12 teams. They started their season so late. I think Washington only played four games.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they're a mystery all around. And then their opening statement was basically, you know, a touchdown on their first drive and then nothing after that. So, to me, I think they're still a mystery to some extent. Maybe a mystery, but trending in the wrong way.
Okay.
But certainly, I mean, you have to wonder if they're actually Pac-12 contenders. Everybody thought it was going to be them or Oregon in that division, and now it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to take I think I'm going to take Michigan in the points on that one. Moving on, we haven't even talked about the first game of the Big Ten season. It really kind of set the tone for the Big Ten season. Nebraska-Illinois. Thank you, Nebraska, for saving the season once again.
Yeah, totally. You know, not to jump around, but, you know, Illinois followed that up with a loss to Texas San Antonio. So now I am demanding a Nebraska-Texas San Antonio matchup.
I mean, Illinois, the question there is Illinois any better under Burt now? And, I mean, Nebraska was coming back at the end of that game, so it wasn't like Illinois mm-hmm. just crushed him in that game. But Adrian Martinez looks broken. Illinois does not look like any better team than we thought they were going to be. I think that's the bottom of the Big Ten right there. Now, Nebraska did just rip up Fordham, but I don't know if Fordham is a real team. So we still have people checking on that, whether that's an actual team or, like, you know, the Columbus whatever.
I mean, when you're playing a college football team from New York City, are you really playing a college football team?
So go ahead.
Well, one thing I just want to throw in here real fast is that Adrian Martinez finished with 50% completion against Fordham. So he was 16 for 32.
Wow. Oh.
Did he throw any interceptions?
No interceptions, 7.2 yards per attempt.
Wow. You know, that's I asked that because 17 of their last 19 turnovers, at least after the Illinois game, were committed by a Nebraska quarterback, be it Luke McCaffrey, who's now transferred, or Adrian Martinez. So, like, they have this huge turnover problem, but it almost always comes from interceptions, or Adrian Martinez fumbles a lot when he runs with the football. I remember last year the Rutgers game was close because he kept fumbling, and he had a huge fumble against Illinois. You know, that game could have been tied at halftime, but instead he somehow, even in his fourth year, has no ball security. And Illinois scooped it up and scored it. It was 16-9. And really, they kind of turtled the second half at the start. And I can't help but think it was just because of that play. And it was the same old for Nebraska.
All right, moving on up our list of great teams of the Big Ten. Rutgers 61, Temple 14. Do we learn anything about Rutgers? Is Rutgers good? Is Rutgers deserve to move out of the Big Ten East bottom now?
I mean, they scored 61 points. Did they even have 350 total yards? I mean, I think they had like 5.9 yards per point. and they scored 61 points. Those numbers, that's some hard math to figure out.
Yeah, well, Temple's quarterback went to Michigan State this year. So, like, people remember Temple being pretty good and having a decent defense, but, like, Temple got gutted, and their quarterback, DeJuan Mathis, went 8 of 25 or 148 yards in interception. Rutgers quarterbacks went 15 of 27 for 138 yards, and then Johnny Langan came back, and the first was Noah Vedral again, and then they brought in Johnny Langan a little bit, and he just threw two passes. Didn't really need their quarterbacks in this one, but after the game, the news was that their quarterback recruit for 2022 is reclassifying and enrolling right now.
I saw that.
Pacheco.
I mean, that's like golden era of Rutgers football material right there. 61 points, and your stud quarterback is like, I'm getting started early with you guys.
is that gonna affect things? Is he gonna come in and start right away? I don't want to ask questions about Rutgers admissions. I'm sure everything's on the up and up there. And that, you know, enrolling a high schooler immediately in the fall because your quarterback situation looks dire is not a problem at all. I don't know what to make of that game because I thought Temple was going to be terrible this year, and they are. But, you know, it's a more impressive win than some schools got this week.
I mean, Rutgers definitely improved last year, but I feel like anytime they win, it doesn't matter who the opponent is, it's still a thumbs up for Rutgers.
Right. All right, moving on. This game was kind of interesting. Maryland versus West Virginia. Maryland 30, West Virginia 24. Maryland comes back and wins it at the end. And Taulia Tagovailoa kind of looks like a quarterback again. And are they a danger when they've got him going?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not as much of Tagovailoa, but they have two stud wideouts, Dante Demas and especially Rakeem Jarrett. They both, Demas went for six catches, 133. Jarrett, six catches, 122. Demas had a 60-yard TD. Jarrett had a 66-yard TD. And they each had a separate drive where they came up with multiple big plays that led to Maryland points. So Maryland had 13 drives yesterday, and four of them were dominated by the Tagovailoa, Demas, Jarrett combination. That's one out of every three drives, basically, you know, and that's pretty impressive. Now, to throw a little cold water on that, we've seen this before out of Maryland, right?
Right.
Texas, Syracuse, they seem to every year put it up on a non-conference opponent, and we get all excited, you know, and let's see what's going to go on. But this does feel a little bit more legit. I liked what I saw out of their defense as well. They shut West Virginia out basically in the second half. And, you know, one problem last year with the defense, they improved to 44th in the defensive efficiency S&P, which isn't the best for a Power 5 team, but it's an improvement. They didn't get any turnovers last year. They only generated four turnovers last year. In yesterday's game against West Virginia, they got four turnovers. So, you know, if this is a defense that can suddenly, you know, generate 20 turnovers on the season, that could be just enough defense to help this offense out, and we won't see a collapse in the Big Ten season like we have after those previous years where they opened so well.
Well, and Maryland's schedule sets up really well. They have Howard next week, Illinois after that, and then Kent State. So we could easily be rolling into October with the 4-0 Terps and sort of some buzz around their program.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
I think the scariest part was that the offensive line did not look god-awful against a Power 5 team. And that was like the big thing about Maryland was their offensive linemen were awful last year. And like they brought back the same guys. So, I mean, they were able to run the ball. They were able to, you know, to protect Tagovailoa long enough for him to get the ball to his receivers. And I mean, you do not want to have Demas and Jarrett out there in space against your guys. I mean, it doesn't matter who you've got. Like, those two guys are going to get their yards. So maybe Maryland's got some fight.
Yeah, they allowed 3.5 sacks per game last year. They only allowed 2 sacks against West Virginia, and one was on some really weird broken fourth down play that just didn't work from the start. You know, so that's not necessarily like what happened to the pass protection on that play. So yeah, they gave him time, and I mean, he's got two NFL receivers out there, especially Jarrett. I mean, he's a 5-star. We saw him last year tear up Penn State, for example. So I mean, he's legit.
All right. Purdue 30, Oregon State 21. Jack Plummer goes 29 for 41. Xander Horvath rushed for 81 yards. So they kind of don't have the they don't really have much of a running game. But David Bell had 134 yards, and I think they've got a new little receiver guy in Payne Durham. And by little receiver guy, I mean the tight end.
They've made big plays with Bryson Hopkins the last 2 years at that tight end spot. And in game one of replacing him, Payne Durham, 7 catches, 120 yards, including a 50-yard touchdown pass to ice the game in the fourth quarter. And that was important because since Brohm has gotten to Purdue, they're 8-16 in one-score games. Now, this was a 9-point win, so it doesn't count as a win in the one-score game ledger. But to see Purdue make a play and put the game away instead of, not making a play, committing a bad penalty, and the defense giving it up. It was just good to see Purdue, come through there in the end. Because I think that we all think that they're such an improved program under Brohm, but yet not enough wins have yet come of it because they keep losing games late. And it was just nice to see them not lose a game late.
Yeah, and they came up big. They had like the fourth down stop when it looked like Oregon State was about to pop back at them. And I think they did that a couple times against Oregon State, but Oregon State was not supposed to be a very good Pac-12 team. So I'm still not sure about the Purdue defense here.
Yeah, I'm not sure about them either. Oregon State played a couple quarterbacks. It looks like both were, somewhat effective. We'll learn a lot about Purdue, though. They play Notre Dame here in a couple of weeks, a renewal of that rivalry. So we'll find out just how improved they are. But the offense looked pretty good. You mentioned Horvath. I'm a big fan of Horvath. Thing with Purdue is they're going to get 300 yards through the air. They're always going to have a couple receivers that threaten 100 yards. And if they can get Horvath involved, he's a good bet to get 100 total yards rushing and receiving. He wasn't used that much in the receiving game on Saturday. But like you said, he had 81 rushing yards, including an 11-yard touchdown run out of the Wildcat. So, I think that he can be, an X factor for them at running back. It's just sometimes they forget he's on the team.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some of the interesting games after we talked about all these crazy ones.
That's way too much about Purdue.
Yeah. Michigan State 38, Northwestern 21. Michigan State proved that they can run the ball. Northwestern, Hunter Johnson did not actually look broken, except for the times that he did. But I think the big thing is that Michigan State has Kenneth Walker, and he's legit.
Yes, I would agree. There was a lot of talk all offseason about the transfers that Mel Tucker brought in, and there was a lot of debate. Are these guys going to be good enough to improve the team or not? But it seemed like everybody was in agreement that Kenneth Walker III was a stud coming over from Wake Forest. He's got great vision. He's got great change of direction. 23 carries, 264 yards, including a 75-yard touchdown run on the first play of the game. He had runs of 75, 50, 30, 23, 16, and 14 yards, and he scored 4 touchdowns, rather. And two notes on that. He now has 17 touchdowns on his last 142 carries. And also, last year, Michigan State did not have a single rushing touchdown out of the running back position. They got 4 out of their transfer, including one on the first play of the game. So they definitely appear to have something running the football, finally. I mean, they really haven't had that the last couple of years.
Alex?
Yeah. I mean, Walker was an absolute beast in this game, but the Northwestern offense part is interesting because they put up 399 yards, and we know that Northwestern is not a good offensive team under Pat Fitzgerald pretty much ever. Mm-hmm. Their yards per play wasn't great at 4.8. They just ran a lot more plays than MSU did. But, Hunter Johnson didn't look terrible. It's just this Northwestern defense lost a lot of pieces off last year's team, and they got ripped up.
Yeah, that was kind of my take, that Northwestern's not really that good this year. I my preseason hot take was that Northwestern's going to lose the hat to Illinois this year, and I don't know. That take seems like it's kind of good now. Northwestern just... Michigan State did not have any passing game to speak of. They did not really get read free like I thought they would against that defense. Peyton Thorne did not impress. Yeah, but without that running game, and you know, you can shut down even really good running backs if you can beat their beat the Lions. So I don't know if I'm buying Michigan State right now either. I kind of do that to Michigan State every year, though.
Yeah, I said last week that if they beat Northwestern, that Michigan State would have a solid chance at bowl eligibility with games against Purdue and Maryland in November. But especially the Maryland game, those games look harder now, even though Michigan State won.
Yeah.
So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Getting back to what Alex said about Northwestern's offense moving the football, you know, Michigan State got out to a 14-0 lead, but after each of those touchdowns, Northwestern drove the ball into Michigan State's red zone, and they missed a field goal, and they turned it over on downs after an incomplete pass on 3rd and 7 and an incomplete pass on 4th and 7. So, you know, points per possession inside the 40, which is one of the five factors of winning, Michigan State was 5.4, Northwestern was 3.
Okay.
Because they missed a couple other opportunities. They missed a couple other opportunities during the game as well. They missed another field goal on their first drive of the third quarter. So they had three really good looking drives that came up empty. And if they max out on those drives, it's 21 apiece in the third quarter. But if they even just get a combination of scores on those drives, it's anybody's ball game in the second half.
All right. We're finally to the three big games. Let's start with Penn State, Wisconsin, which was really fun to kind of have them keep on cutting to that game during our game because, like, you know, Michigan starts taking care of Western and immediately they're like, Penn State, Wisconsin, rock fight. And
yeah.
I guess finally Jahan Dotson broke free and got a touchdown. And then, but it was, this was not an impressive game for either one of these teams, was it?
I mean, I enjoyed watching it. You know, I mean, it's funny during the Wisconsin-Penn State game, there's nothing but hate being thrown on the game. But later in the night when Clemson and Georgia are rock fighting, it's like a gem. So
yeah.
maybe I'm just a little, you know, chip on my shoulder with that. But I thought it was a good game because there's a lot to chew on. Wisconsin blew the game in the first half. They could have had a comfortable lead at halftime, but they had a first and goal. They committed some penalties. They had a field goal blocked. Then they had another first and goal. Then they fumbled the handoff exchange, and that was a turnover. So
yeah.
They could have been up 14-0 or 10-0 at halftime at a minimum, and instead it was 0-0. When Dotson got behind the defense on Penn State's first drive, all of a sudden it's boom, Penn State's up 7-0, and they hadn't done a thing all day.
Yeah.
And at that point, the Nittany Lions are off the mat, and, you know, you're in a ball game.
Yeah, I mean, Graham Mertz, that you talked about the fumble, that was one of three interceptions that I put on Mertz, three turnovers that were all really on Mertz.
Yeah.
You know, he looked good against Illinois last year and then kind of was, you know, your standard Wisconsin quarterback the rest of the season, and it looks like that's kind of what they got in this guy, whereas Wisconsin's defense, like, just does that to you.
Yeah, about that opener last year. I mean, is that the only graphic that people will ever show about Mertz? I mean, they showed and talked about his Illinois opener several times during the broadcast. And it's like, what about the other games? But yeah, you know, the turnovers, he screwed up a handoff exchange in a first and goal situation in the fourth quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a situation where they needed to score a touchdown because they were down 16-10. And, you know, a couple plays later, he throws that interception to, was it Brisket? Brisker? Jaquan Brisker?
Yeah. Yeah. Who, by the way,
Penn State had terrible ball security.
Yeah. Brisker left the game, I think, twice and then came back and was the guy who put this away. So, I mean, shout out to that dude. He was a star for Penn State last year. Not enough people were talking about him. And,
yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty gutsy performance to get knocked out of a game twice for two different reasons and then come back and actually perform like that.
Right. And it's not like you're coming back in, you know, playing Illinois or something. You're coming in and playing one of the you're coming back in hurt playing one of the more physical teams in the league. And that was a physical game too. And, you know, about that interception, two things. One, even if Brisker doesn't step in front of it, that ball is not being completed. He skied it over Ferguson.
Yeah.
I don't know how you can constantly sky a pass over your tight end, but he sure knows how to do that. And two, I think you have to mention the fact that he took that ball and returned it from the goal line almost to midfield.
Right.
So when they had to punt the ball back to Wisconsin with a minute to go, Wisconsin had to go the whole field instead of half the field. So that return was as impressive as just the interception.
Yep. All right. Can't hold Bach back any longer. It's time to do this to you, man. Iowa 34, Indiana 6. Michael Penix did not look great.
I don't seem to have any notes on that game. Are you sure that took place? What happened here? Let me see. I don't have any notes. I know that the soccer team is doing really well, and the basketball recruiting is great. I mean, Mike Woodson is like a B-level Juwan Howard recruiter right now, so we could talk about that. But, yeah, what a disaster. They gave up a big run to Tyler Goodson, who I think might be the best running back in the Big Ten now that Mo Ibrahim is out.
Yep.
And then on their second play on offense, they get a pick six. So, boom, boom, it's 14-0. They sort of get on steady ground a little bit, and then the final 2 minutes of the first half was like the first 2 minutes of the game. They gave up another pick six, and then Penix threw another pick right soon after and gave him 3 points before halftime. So, I mean, it was just a controlled scrimmage after that in the second half. You're not going to come back from Iowa when you're down 4 touchdowns at halftime.
Yeah, and Iowa was not necessarily playing that great. Spencer Petras is only 13-28. But I thought the big thing in this game was that Indiana could not move the ball on the ground. They got that 5-star running back, Stephen Carr from USC, and their offensive line, you know, Carpenter was supposed to, you know, jump in and make the rest of those guys a little bit better, and I don't know, like,
He didn't play.
Yeah.
He wasn't in the starting lineup.
He's not even in there, so, like, you know, that's if they can't run the ball, because Penix, you know, he's a great player, but he's not a runner. I mean, we all remember that one time he ran against Penn State,
right.
But like, that's not his game really. And if you know, Freifogel looked like himself. Hendershot looked like a you know, the same red zone threat that he's always been. It was just, when you don't have Penix working, that offense really falls off the cliff.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes it feels like the IU offense is just like, let's put Penix in the pocket and sling it around and see if he can't make a big play. And sometimes that includes throwing it into coverage to see if Freifogel or one of the other receivers can come down with it. There just doesn't seem to be, you know, much of a strategy sometimes with the passing attack other than just flinging it around. And like you said, they run the ball ad nauseum and it never goes anywhere. They had like 35 carries and they were behind the whole game. I was surprised that they ran the ball that much, and it just never seemed to work. Indiana only gained 19.9 of the available yards, and they only had 2 first downs on 20% of their drives. Those are significantly both below the national average. Iowa came in below the national average on both those stats, but they were still way better than Indiana at both of them.
Yeah, and people are a little sleeping on Iowa's defense a little bit. I don't think that's going to happen against everybody, but, I mean, it should not have happened to that degree, especially because Iowa's front was not supposed to be that good. Speaking of fronts,
I actually kind of thought that Indiana might be catching Iowa at the right time, because outside of Linderbaum, they don't have a lot of experience on the offensive line, and, yeah, they were going with redshirt freshmen at defensive tackle to replace guys like Davion Nix, and I know IU's not the strongest in the trenches, but I was sort of like, this could be like one time in an Iowa matchup where they might be able to hold their own, and that was not the case at all. Those defensive tackles played great.
Yeah, so not looking good for my Indiana as the champions of the East. However...
No, and just one quick note on that. They play Cincinnati in 2 weeks, so like, they got to get their act together.
Yeah, but that doesn't count for the Big Ten. We need them to do is knock off Ohio State, who looked like knock-offable against Minnesota. Row the boat. We were all rowing the boat very, very hard. I mean, This is just one of those Ohio State games where, like, you know, they show it to you, they convince you you can do it, and then all of a sudden they have Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave and you don't.
The average length of the 6 Ohio State touchdowns was 54.8 yards. I mean, they didn't even have like a 9-yard touchdown to take that average down. They were all big plays. And I mean, I'm going to repeat that again. 6 touchdowns, and on average, they covered more than half the field on those touchdowns. So,
right. And that's
very explosive.
That's the problem playing Ohio State, is that they can kind of do that to you whenever they want to. They also, you know, Mayan Williams, every single time he got the ball, it looked like he was breaking loose. You catch him from behind, but by the time you caught him from behind, they've got 60 yards already.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Trevion Henderson, you know, that catch and run, that pretty much sealed it, right? Like, that's what they do to you, right? They knock out Mo Ibrahim, they give you mm-hmm. a chance, all right? And then, like, you think you got it. Like, okay, we can make this happen. And then they knock out your great running back who gave up the NFL to come back another year, and they're like, oh, we've got this freshman, Trevion Henderson, and he's going to be better than Mo Ibrahim. And that's... I hate this. I hate what Ohio State is. I hate that, like, this is just so inevitable. And when you look at the box score at the end, it doesn't even look like this game was competitive, even though we all watched it. We were all there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I thought C.J. Stroud was a little shaky. I mean, there were definitely several balls that it was like, well, if this is Fields last year, that's a touchdown. Like, guys are mm-hmm. open down the field. And, you know, just wasn't quite hitting nearly as high a percentage of those deep balls as Fields was. And that at least gives you a shot to beat Ohio State, because you're not going to cover their receivers perfectly all the time. You need their quarterback to mess up sometimes. And he did that a little bit. So, you know, I don't know. We'll see how the rest of the season goes.
Yeah, that's a good observation. PFF had a post the day after the game that detailed that Stroud threw uncatchable balls like on half his attempts. And, like, Fields never even came close to that, as an example. And that stat might be, you know, more of a testament of how great Fields was, but, you know, maybe shows that for the first time in a few years, they might have a mere mortal at quarterback, at least for now, while he's in his first season playing.
Yeah, I thought, Ohio State, that's the best pass protection offensive line you can get in college football this year, and maybe one of the best of all time. They moved a first-round left tackle inside, so they can get another...
Yeah, Thayer Mumford.
Yeah. So, I mean, there was... And they were giving Stroud a lot of time. So he was just plain missing mm-hmm. when he had a very, very clean pocket. That guy's not going to kill you. But, like, the amount that Olave can get open when you give him that much time, that's the thing. Ohio State just has so many ways that they can just destroy you in 3 seconds, and that's what happens. Like, if you don't keep it going, if you don't keep on having great luck the whole like, something's gonna break, and then, you know, they only need that inch, because, you know, Olave is gonna break free, or Mayan Williams is gonna, you know, crack your edge, and all of a sudden it's over.
Yeah, one of Olave's touchdowns was a 38 yard catch and run, and I mean, he had to cross the whole field before Stroud threw it, so it was a long developing play, and he had all the time in the world to just drop that throw in there and wait for Olave to get to the spot. Ohio State didn't allow any sacks against Minnesota. They only allowed 2 hurries, only 2 stuffed runs, and they only had 1 negative play all game. So, yeah, they definitely dominated up front. But we've said this a couple times already on the podcast via team's good performance. You know, Minnesota's defense, and especially their pass rush, is not their strength. So... But on the other hand, you know, we'd be looking forward to seeing this offensive line go up against Oregon and Kenyon Thibodeau next weekend, but Thibodeau got hurt in the opener against Fresno and was in a boot during the second half, so I doubt he's even going to play. Because that would be a juicy matchup next Saturday to see how they can contain him, but I don't think they're going to have to deal with it. I mean, I know it's a bummer that Ibrahim is out, and they're gonna miss him. I mean, that's an NFL running back. I think behind that offensive line, though, they can still run the ball with Cam Wiley and Terry Potts. I mean, there were some times where they broke out some formations on Thursday night where I was like, am I watching Wisconsin or peak Stanford? You know, they got 7, 8 offensive linemen out there sometimes. It was quite impressive watching Fleck try to use all that talent that they suddenly have on the offensive line.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think that was strategic. That, like, if you're playing Ohio State, you don't really want to run into the defensive tackles. Because they're great, but they've got some real pass rushers on the outside who maybe you can kind of kick out if you're giving your guys more gaps to play with. And they're a very RPO based team, and they were running RPOs on most of those runs that Ibrahim was getting. They were messing with the linebackers and then giving him those extra gaps, I thought, was the right strategy. So I thought Fleck really had a great game plan against Ohio State, and you know, that put them in the game. It's just Tanner Morgan is not accurate enough to keep it going. Their offensive line can't mm-hmm. survive if you get off schedule. So every single time they got in third and long, we're like, yep, it's over. And again,
And they didn't have, Chris Ottman Bell at wide receiver either. So third and longs were even more of a problem because they're really green at wide receiver without him. But they still had some pretty good offensive numbers. They gained 53% of the available yards. That's well above the national average. They had 55% of their drives had at least two first downs. That's way above average. And they were successful on pass plays, a 52% success rate on pass plays, a 56% success rate on passing downs. I know that that Ohio State was down a couple guys in the secondary, and they're really going young, it seems like, too, on their back seven. But considering I didn't have a lot of expectations for Minnesota throwing the ball, and they didn't have Chris Ottman Bell, I mean, there were some good things that they did against Ohio State, I thought. And I think they have a real soft schedule, and I'm interested in see what they do from here. They got Miami of Ohio, at Colorado, Bowling Green, at Purdue, Nebraska, Maryland, at Northwestern, Illinois. I mean, even without Mo Ibrahim, there's probably 6 wins out of their next 8. And depending on who they are, they could still be in this West race come November.
So who do you like better, Oregon against Ohio State or Buffalo against Nebraska?
Buffalo. Buffalo. They've been feisty. They've been feisty the last couple years.
Mo Linguist versus Scott Frost. All right, I can see that one too. Thank you very much, Jamie. Always appreciate you coming on. Really glad to have you back. Good to have football back. Good to feel a little optimism again. Thank you for listening to the MGO podcast. I'm Seth Fisher, along with Brian Cook and Alex Drain. And no, my covers are not cursed!